On this 16th day of April, 1945, the United States of America turns a new page in its history. A new president makes his first official appearance before Congress, assembled in joint session in the chamber of the House of Representatives, Capitol Building, Washington. Harry S. Truman, who took the oath of office as president only last Thursday, after the tragic passing of Franklin Delano Roosevelt at Warm Springs, Georgia, is today making his first open bid for unity among the various branches of government. It is generally expected that President Truman will acquaint Congress with his war and peace. Earlier today, he conferred with his Secretary of State, Edward R. Stettinius, and later met with British Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden. Mr. Eden delivered an expression of goodwill from Prime Minister Winston Churchill. The House chamber today is accommodating members of both houses of Congress, members of the Cabinet, and Supreme Court. Speaker Rayburn of the House has appointed an escorting committee composed of Mr. McCormick, Mr. Dalton, and Mr. Martin, and pro tempore Chairman of the Senate, Mr. McKellar, has appointed a committee composed of Mr. Barkley of Kentucky, Mr. White of Maine, and Senator George of Georgia. In just a moment, the escorting committee will be coming through the rear door of the House chamber, accompanying President Truman down the aisle and to the Speaker's rostrum, from which point he will address both members of the Houses of Congress, also the various guests assembled. The galleries are completely filled today, as they usually are when a president addresses Congress. Incidentally, in the executive gallery just over my head, the new First Lady, Mrs. Bess Truman, together with Mrs. Margaret Truman, are seated in the front row, looking upon the festivities here in the House chamber today. In just a moment, Sergeant-at-Arms Kenneth Romney of the House of Representatives and the Sergeant-at-Arms of the Senate, Mr. Waldoxy, will be presenting themselves at the rear door of the House chamber. Now, here's the announcement.
Speaker, the President of the United States.
There's your announcement now, President Truman, who soon will be making his way through the rear door. There's the applause greeting President Truman. This is his first official appearance before this Congress. In just a moment, you will hear the voice of President Truman as he makes his first official speech as President of the United States. Now there's the escorting committee down at the House bell. President Truman is rising those three or four steps up to the area where the reading clerk of the House generally holds forth. Now he's shaking hands with Mr. McKellar and Speaker Rayburn. The escorting committee makes its way past the platform. Now Mr. Truman smiles and waves to the members of the House and Senate, and in just a moment you'll hear the voice of Speaker Rayburn as he introduces President Truman.
Just a moment. Let me present you, will you, Harry?
Sure.
Members of the Congress, I have the great pleasure and the high privilege of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Speaker,
members of the Congress,
Mr. President,
it is with a heavy
members
heart
of the Congress
that I stand before you.
It is with a heavy heart
and colleagues
that I stand before you, my friends and colleagues in the Congress of the United States.
We laid to rest the mortal
only yesterday
of our beloved president,
we laid to rest
Delano,
the mortal remains of our beloved president,
like
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Words are inadequate.
At a time like this,
the most eloquent tribute,
words are inadequate.
Would be a reverent silence.
The most eloquent tribute would be a reverent silence.
When world events are moving
yet
so
in this
rapid,
decisive hour, when world events are moving so rapidly, our silence might be misunderstood and might give comfort to our enemies. In his infinite wisdom, Almighty God has seen fit to take from us a great man who loved and was beloved by all humanity. No man could possibly fill the tremendous void left by the passing of that noble soul. No words can ease the aching hearts of untold millions of every race, creed, and color. The world knows it has lost a heroic champion of justice and freedom. Tragic fate has thrust upon us grave responsibility. We must carry on. Our departed leader never looked backward.
That is what he would
do. He looked forward and moved forward.
That is what America
that is what he would want us to do. That is what America will do. So much blood has already been shed for the ideals which we cherish and for which Franklin Delano Roosevelt lived and died that we dare not permit even a momentary pause in the hard fight for victory. Today, the entire world is looking to America for enlightened leadership to peace and progress. Such a leadership requires vision, courage, and tolerance. It can be provided only by a united nation deeply devoted to the highest ideals. With great humility, I call upon all Americans to help me keep our nation united in defense of those ideals which have been so eloquently proclaimed by Franklin Roosevelt. I want, in turn, to assure my fellow Americans and all of those who love peace and liberty throughout the world that I will support and defend those ideals with all my strength and all my heart. That is my duty, and I shall not shirk it. So that there can be no possible misunderstanding, both Germany and Japan can be certain, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that America will continue the fight for freedom until no vestige of resistance remains. We are deeply conscious of the fact that much hard fighting is still ahead of us. Having to pay such a heavy price to make complete victory certain, America will never become a party to any plan for partial victory. To settle for merely another temporary respite would surely jeopardize the future security of all the world. Our demand has been, and it remains, unconditional surrender. Traffic with the breakers of the peace on the terms of the peace. The responsibility for making of the peace, and it is a very grave responsibility, must rest with the defenders of the peace. We are not unconscious of the dictates of humanity. We do not wish to see unnecessary or unjustified suffering. But the laws of God and of man have been violated, and the guilty must not go unpunished. Nothing shall shake our determination to punish the war criminals, even though we must pursue them to the ends of the earth. Lasting peace can never be secured if we permit our dangerous opponents to plot future wars with impunity at any mountain retreat, however distant. In this shrinking world, it is futile to think safety behind geographical barriers. Real security will be found only in law and in justice. Here in America, we have labored long and hard to achieve a social order worthy of our great heritage. In our time, tremendous progress has been made toward a really democratic way of life. Let me assure the forward-looking people of America that there will be no relaxation in our efforts to improve the lot of the common people. In the difficult days ahead, unquestionably, we shall face problems of staggering proportions. However, with the faith of our fathers in our hearts, we do not fear the future. On the battlefields, we have frequently faced overwhelming odds and won. At home, Americans will not be less resolute. We shall never cease our struggle to preserve and maintain our American way of life. At this moment, America, along with her brave allies, is paying again a heavy price for the defense of our freedom. With characteristic energy, we are assisting in the liberation of entire nations. Gradually, the shackles of slavery are being broken by the forces of freedom. All of us are praying for a speedy victory. Every day peace is delayed costs a terrible toll. The armies of liberation today are bringing to an end Hitler's ghastly threat to dominate the world. Tokyo rocks under the weight of our bombs. The grand strategy of the United Nations war has been determined, due in no small measure to the vision of our departed Commander-in-Chief. We are now carrying out our part of that strategy under the able direction of Admiral Leahy, General Marshall, Admiral King, General Arnold, General Eisenhower, Admiral Nimitz, and General MacArthur. I want the entire world to know that this direction must and will remain unchanged and unhampered. Our debt to the heroic men and valiant women in the service of our country can never be repaid. They have earned our undying gratitude. America will never forget their sacrifices. Because of these sacrifices, the dawn of justice and freedom throughout the world slowly casts its gleam across the horizon. Our forefathers came to our rugged shores in search of religious tolerance, political freedom, and economic opportunity. For those fundamental rights, they risked their lives. We well know today that such rights can be preserved only by constant vigilance, the eternal price of liberty. Within an hour after I took the oath of office, I announced that the San Francisco conference would proceed. We will face the problems of peace with the same courage that we have faced and mastered the problems of war. In the memory of those who have made the supreme sacrifice, in the memory of our fallen president, we shall not fail. It is not enough to yearn for peace. We must work and, if necessary, fight for it. The task of creating a sound international organization is complicated and difficult. Yet without such organization, the rights of man on earth cannot be protected. Machinery for the just settlement of international differences must be found. Without such machinery, the entire world will have to remain an armed camp. The world will be doomed to deadly conflict, devoid of hope for real peace. Fortunately, people have retained hope for a durable peace. Thoughtful people have always had faith that ultimately justice must triumph. Past experience surely indicates that without justice, an enduring peace becomes impossible. In bitter despair, some people have come to believe that wars are inevitable. With tragic fatalism, they insist that wars have always been of necessity, and of necessity, wars always will be. To such defeatism, men and women of goodwill must not and cannot yield. The outlook for humanity is not so hopeless. During the dark hours of this horrible war, entire nations were kept going by something intangible, hope. When warned that abject submission offered the only salvation against overwhelming power, hope showed the way to victory. Hope has become the secret weapon of the forces of liberation. Aggressors could not dominate the human mind. As long as hope remains, the spirit of man will never be crushed. But hope alone was not and is not sufficient to avert war. We must not only have hope, but we must have faith enough to work with other peace-loving nations to maintain the peace. Hope was not enough to beat back the aggressors as long as peace-loving nations were unwilling to come to each other's defense. The aggressors were beaten back only when the peace-loving nations united to defend themselves. If wars in the future are to be prevented, nations must be united in their determination to keep the peace under law. Nothing is more essential to the future peace of the world than continued cooperation of the nations which had to muster the force necessary to defeat the conspiracy of the Axis powers to dominate the world. While these great states have a special responsibility to enforce the peace, their responsibility is based upon the obligations resting upon all states, large and small, not to use force in international relations except in the defense of law. The responsibility of the great states is to serve and not to dominate the world. To build the foundation of an enduring peace, we must not only work in harmony with our friends abroad, but we must have the united support of our own people. Even the most experienced pilot cannot bring a ship safely into harbor unless he has the full cooperation of the crew. For the benefit of all, every individual must do his duty. I appeal to every American, regardless of party, race, creed, or color, to support our efforts to build a strong and lasting United Nations organization. You, the members of the Congress, surely know how I feel. Only with your help can I hope to complete one of the greatest tasks ever assigned to a public servant. With divine guidance and your help, we will find the new passage to a far better world, a kindly and friendly world, with just and lasting peace. With confidence, I am depending upon all of you. To destroy greedy tyrants, with dreams of world domination, we cannot continue in successive generations to sacrifice our finest youth. In the name of human decency and civilization, a more rational method of deciding national differences must and will be found. America must assist suffering humanity back along the path of peaceful progress. This will require time and tolerance. We shall need also an abiding faith in the people, the kind of faith and courage which Franklin Delano Roosevelt always had. Today, America has become one of the most powerful forces for good on earth. We must keep it so. We have achieved a world leadership which does not depend solely upon our military and naval might. We have learned to fight with other nations in common defense of our freedom. We must now learn to live with other nations for our mutual good. We must learn to trade more with other nations so that there may be, for our mutual advantage, increased production, increased employment, and better standards of living throughout the world. May we Americans all live up to our glorious heritage. In that way, America may well lead the world to peace and prosperity. At this moment, I have in my heart a prayer. As I have assumed my heavy duties, I humbly pray Almighty God, in the words of King Solomon, "Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this, thy so great people? I ask only to be a good and faithful servant of my Lord and my people."
Ladies and gentlemen, our national anthem. This, President Truman's first official appearance before Congress, was also witnessed by members of the Cabinet, Supreme Court, and other distinguished guests. The President has just now made his way from the House chamber, and in a few moments, the House and Senate will resume their normal legislative days. Now here is Richard Harkness, NBC commentator, to give you highlights of the occasion and the address by President Truman. Mr. Harkness.
Good afternoon, everyone. President Truman gave the people of the United States and the people of the world three flat, definite promises this afternoon. He promised first, and he pointed out that our demand has been in this war, and he promised our demand remains unconditional surrender of the Axis. And in making this promise, President Truman promised, too, that the military command of our American forces will remain, as he put it, unchanged and unhampered. The president's second promise dealt with world peace. President Truman promised here the realization of Mr. Roosevelt's dream of permanent world peace. As Mr. Truman put it, with his Midwestern simplicity, we shall not fail. And as an important side note here, just a line in his speech, Mr. Truman held out a pledge of equality to the so-called little nations, which will participate in the United Nations World Conference at San Francisco, opening on April 25th. As his third promise, President Truman said that he would carry on the progressive liberalism of the late president. And here again, he practically borrowed a phrase from Mr. Roosevelt's former speeches. President Truman said that he, like President Roosevelt, would have a purpose of improving the lot of the common man. That was the way President Truman put it. Well, many of us here in Washington have seen Franklin Delano Roosevelt come to this historic old House chamber scores of times in the last 12 years. We recall that through the 1930s, he was a Roosevelt fighting for a domestic program, a man with his chin thrust out with the light of battle in his eyes. And then, grim-faced, we saw Mr. Roosevelt ask on December 8, 1941, for a declaration of war against the Axis. And then, only a few short weeks ago, on March 1st, we heard Mr. Roosevelt report to Congress on his aspirations for world security. When he came before Congress, sat down in a chair in the well of the House, and talked informally for almost an hour, giving the Senate and House a report on his conference at Yalta. But today there was a new president speaking to Congress, a new chief executive speaking to the Cabinet and the Supreme Court and to the people of the United States. A congressional clerk called out shortly after 1 o'clock, "Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States." And into this old House chamber walked Harry S. Truman. He came into the chamber with quiet dignity. He was dressed somberly. He wore a black double-breasted suit, an informal suit. He had on a black striped necktie. President Truman's face was set in grim lines as he came into the House. But as he mounted the speaker's rostrum, the assembled congregation gave him a round of warm applause. And it was then and only then that Mr. Truman's face broke into a smile. It was a picture of a man smiling back at his friends. And there was an important note to this first appearance of our new chief executive, a note of complete simplicity, of complete straightforwardness. Thank you.
And this, ladies and gentlemen, concludes our broadcast from the Capitol Building in Washington. This is the National Broadcasting Company.